Welcome to The Connection. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. I don't know about you, but I have a lot of stuff accumulated over many decades. To be honest, I get a lot of pleasure owning many of my things from the experience of finding it and using it, and in some cases, just looking at it, especially artwork. I also have clothes and shoes I never wear anymore, still hanging in my closet, that I can't seem to part with. Today on The Connection, we're going to explore our relationship with our belongings, a behavior that is uniquely human. Now, we come into this world with absolutely nothing and often leave it with an apartment house or storage unit filled with our possessions. Interesting fact here, the median size of a new home in 1980 was about 1,500 square feet. Today, it's closer to 2,500 square feet, room for much more stuff. The things we own say a lot about who we are. They're part of our identity, our interests, our tastes, even our feelings about our relationships, especially with our family. Our guest is Bruce Hood. He's a developmental psychologist at the University of Bristol in England, and he wrote a book a few years ago titled Possessed, Why We Want More Than We Need. Bruce Hood, it's great to have you with us on The Connection today.
Thank you so much, Marty. It's a delight to be here.
Nice to have you with us. And let's start at the beginning. And by that, I mean childhood. When did children begin to develop a sense of owning something, this feeling that this teddy bear is mine?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, it's difficult to know exactly the point at which that happens when they start to become sort of possessive. But certainly, if you look at a very young baby, they start off and they haven't got any motor control. But once they start to get the little hands using things, then objects just become an endless source of fascination with them. You know, they bang hammers on the table and they're throwing things. The great Piaget, you know, the great psychologist Jean Piaget argued that really for children, development's all about learning about the physical world. So he described in great detail how children just interact with objects all the time. But I guess it's when they start to get to maybe in their second year, between 1 and 2 years of age, that's where they start to kind of get into little squabbles about things. You know, they're told that they can't have their brother's or their sister's toys, and then they start to become possessive. But before all of that, there is, of course, this really strange behavior that you mentioned, that sometimes they form a real emotional attachment, typically to a soft toy like a teddy bear or a blanket. And that's actually how I got into this whole area of study, because my eldest daughter had this behavior, and it just struck me as the most fascinating, bizarre thing that I needed to look at.
Well, I have a grandson who is absolutely in love with a blanket that is in complete tatters as we speak.
Yeah.
And yet it must be with him for certainly for nighttime or oftentimes wherever he goes. I mean, it is a kind of a, what, transitional object?
Yeah, it is. And I know my eldest daughter is now 30 years of age. She's not listening to this show, thankfully. I'm about to tell you, she still has her blanket.
She does.
And it goes everywhere with her, okay? I mean, she knows it's disgusting and it needs cleaning, but there's something very, very emotional about it all. And this is, to me, is a really interesting behavior. And it's not found everywhere. And her younger sister never formed that attachment. So there's a lot of variation. And we looked at this as students a couple of years back. I asked my students how many of them remembered having these toys, and 2/3 said they'd had these toys as children, but half of them still had them. So these are college students at 18 years of age. So it's a very common phenomenon. It's a very common behavior. And I wanted to know, why does that happen? And what is it about these objects which make them so irreplaceable? So I've been doing all sorts of studies looking into this phenomenon.
Well, I would think, too, I mean, some of it is just nostalgia and memory, but also smells, touch, taste, all those senses that are so powerful, not just for children, but for all of us.
Yeah. So here's what I think is going on with these objects. They're typically found, they're certainly more prominent in Western families, Western cultures. So they're not as common in traditional Japanese culture, for example. This was an interesting difference that I thought needed explaining. And I think the reason is because in traditional Japanese families, the babies sleep with the mothers well into middle childhood. It was very common for the child because they only generally had one child. Mm. Whereas in Western society, we tend to separate the child around about the first year or so. And so I think this causes a little degree of distress, but the child self-soothes with whatever's in the crib, which is typically the blanket or the soft toy like the teddy bear. So over time, I think this becomes a routine and a pattern. So the child gets used to these objects as becoming part of the sleeping routine and for settling down. And I think you're right. I think it is the sensory touch, the smell and the feel of it. But it's more than just that, because by the time they're at 2 years of age, these children are treating these objects as if they have feelings, as if they have thoughts. They think about them as being somewhat alive. And even my eldest daughter still thinks that her blanket gets lonely. So, you know, it's not just simply a sensory thing. It's almost like an extended friend. I've talked about objects in the book as being an extension of our identities. Right. And in many ways, there's a psychological richness to the things that have sentimental value to us, that they're irreplaceable. I'll just tell you one more study, which is quite bizarre. We did a study where we convinced, these were 3-year-olds, we convinced them we had a machine which could copy anything. So it was actually a conjuring trick. So we had these two kind of these two boxes with lights and dials, and they looked like scientific boxes. And we showed the child that if I placed one toy in one of the boxes and turned the dials on, the machine would start up. And then after a minute or two, we opened up the doors on the second box, and there was a second object. Of course, we always had two objects, but we convinced the child we had built a machine that could copy anything. And they thought that was kind of fun. So we invited them into the lab to see if we could copy their toys and to ask them to bring their attachment object. Okay. Now, when it came to their toys, they were quite happy to stick it into the machine to see the second one. But when I offered to put their attachment object in it, a lot of them refused, and indeed some got very upset. So there's something unique and irreplaceable about these attachment objects, which makes them indispensable, which is why you can't just simply swap them around. I've had stories and I've had messages from parents saying, when their child has lost their object, can they just put a different object in place? Very rarely does that happen.
Yeah. Well, you're talking to someone who still has her teddy bear after almost 70 years. But at the same time, and thinking about my teddy bear or even people's blankets, is they're full of stories, our own narrative is kind of built into what this object is. And again, when you add sensory experience, you know that fake blanket isn't the same one as your actual blanket that you love, because it doesn't smell the same.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And it's the basis for why we value certain objects. Objects which have an emotional value to them, sentimental objects, are irreplaceable. And I think this is because of another phenomenon I'm very interested in called essentialism, that when it comes to things that we care about, we imbue with them a sense or a metaphysical property I call an essence, which makes it irreplaceable. Mm-hmm. It's why works of art are so valuable. It's as if you have a connection with the originator, because if you had, in this era, of course, with digital technology, if you had two pictures and one was the original and one was an identical duplicate, people would still prefer and value the original more, even though you couldn't tell the two apart objectively. So in our minds, there's this kind of metaphysical property which defines the authenticity of something. And that's why provenance, and that's why these are such important factors when it comes to the value that we place on art or memorabilia or anything that we're collecting. And of course, it also has a flip side. When you have memorabilia, you also have a phenomenon called murderabilia. And this is where you feel a revulsion. These are things which are connected with people that we are afraid of, like murderers or, you know, Nazi memorabilia. You can't sell that stuff on the internet because it's illegal. And that's because it has this sort of perverse fascination for some people. And I did that. I used to do this stunt when I gave these talks a few years back. I used to ask the audience if they'd be willing to wear a cardigan. And they were a bit reluctant. I said, I'll tell you what, I'll give you $20. And the hands would go up. And I said, would you still wear this cardigan if you knew that it belonged to Jeffrey Dahmer? And of course, all the hands come shooting down. And it's as if there's some sort of contagious element that is inhabiting the clothes. Of course, it wasn't Jeffrey Dahmer's cardigan at all. It was just my cardigan. But the belief was sufficient to make people revolted and repulsed. And again, it taps into this idea that there's this metaphysical property which defines the true nature of something, the authenticity of it. And so it can be positive when it comes to memorabilia, which is why we value anything which has come into physical contact with our heroes, but it can be revulsion when it's things which have come in contact with people that we revile.
I wonder, too, with those things that we hold on from our past, how much of that is driven by nostalgia and how much nostalgia is driven by perhaps a sort of rose-colored view of our past so that it imbues it with happy memories.
Yeah, it's a longing, isn't it? And this is because objects are an extension of ourselves. This is a point that Russell Belk made. He's a marketing person. He's talked about this very strong connection we have with our objects. And so nostalgia, I think you're absolutely right. I think this is why we don't throw things away.
Yeah,
it's part of the reason we don't throw them away is because it's a loss of identity. It's a loss of our history. You know, we don't want to throw our parents' possessions away when they pass on and we inherit everything. It just seems disrespectful to get rid of this stuff. And so this is why we end up accumulating more and more things. It's not until you kind of lose that sort of personal connection that I think you can let these things go. But even then, we still have museums. We have places where people go and revere objects which are connected with very famous people because we want to make that connection.
Well, thinking of connection and attachment, I'm looking at the clock here, about a minute and a half before our break. It's interesting that we give not all inanimate objects that we own, but things like a car, you know, we give it a name. I had an old MG that was always being in the repair shop, so we called it Bill because there was always a bill for this car. But it was part of our affection for this vehicle.
Yeah, that's actually very common. So this is called anthropomorphism. This is where we imbue inanimate things with physical properties. And it was actually the late Dan Denner, who just recently passed away, pointed out that this is what we call taking an intentional stance. So we interact with things as if they are alive because it enables us to kind of have a, if you like, an interaction which is directed or meaningful. But cars, of course, typically have all sorts of names. And there was a report I remember of a company which had lorry drivers. And even though these drivers didn't actually own these particular lorries, invariably they started decorating them, giving them names and personalizing them to sort of mark out their space, as it were. So in this way, again, objects are an extension of who we are.
And I've seen trucks like that on the highway with names, you know, whatever the name of that truck is. Let's take that very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation with Bruce Hood. He's a developmental psychologist in society at the University of Bristol. And he wrote a book a couple of years ago, a really interesting book called Possessed, Why We Want More Than We Need. And we are talking about our possessions, why they mean so much to us, why they are hard to let go. We'll be talking about collecting and also a bit about what happens when we can't let things go. Much more after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. We're talking about why we become attached to our belongings. And again, our guest is psychologist Bruce Hood. In my introduction, I talked about this as a uniquely human trait, this idea of ownership or possession. Is it what sets us apart from other creatures on this planet?
Yes, generally true. I mean, animals will fight over possessions. So they'll fight over territories and they'll fight over mates and they'll fight over food. So they do have this kind of notion that things are controlled. But ownership is different because ownership is not just possession. It's a convention. It's an acknowledgement that property belongs to someone in perpetuity so that when you're not present, no one can just help themselves to it, okay, because that would be theft. So animals will fight over things, but they don't have this concept of defending property that belongs to other people. And I think that's the big difference. The other thing, of course, is that we make tools. Now, other animals make tools as well, but after they've used the tool, they just throw it away. Whereas if you walk into any sort of typical mail, they'll have a shed full of tools.
Yes, so they do.
They kind of they collect them. So we collect things. And if you look right back into the early archaeological record, the beginnings of our civilizations, you can see as hunter-gatherers, we were actually making things, and burial gifts that were put into the grave. So these would have been personal possessions in a belief of the afterlife that they could take with them. But I think it's when we settled down after the last ice age and we started to form agriculture and farms where we couldn't carry a lot of things. This is when we started to accumulate property. We'd fence off the land, we'd build storage, we'd have more and more things so that we could pass them on to our younger generations. So I think it has changed in the course of human development. As hunter-gatherers, we tended not to have a lot of things to carry around. But then when we settled down, this became the natural course.
I read that your family motto is, or was, quote, "This I'll defend."
Oh, that's right. I forgot about that. That's right, yes.
Which kind of underscores the point you were just making, right?
That's right, of course, exactly. And that's important that, there were... In some cultures, of course, this doesn't exist. So, for example, in the hunter-gatherers, there's one last tribe left in Tanzania called the Hadza. They don't have this possessiveness of ownership. For them, they have a concept called demand sharing, which means that it's communal ownership. Anyone can help themselves to something if it's not being used. And that makes a lot of sense, because if you're constantly on the move, you don't have a lot of things that you can kind of control. So they just generally share everything. Whereas in our Western cultures, we've become more individualistic and we've become much more territorial about our property as we fence it off. And that, of course, comes with a whole lot of problems.
Well, and I wonder if it even becomes even more sort of unique to Americans in that we are a land, except, of course, for the native people here, of immigrants coming here looking for a better life. So coming with certain wants while we set up this country.
Well, famously, as you probably know, the indigenous peoples did not have a concept of ownership of land.
That's right.
That's why they were quite happy to sell Manhattan off, because they thought these Westerners are clueless. So they're money for something that can't be owned. But of course, we came to these lands with a totally different view, which is that you can fence it off and control it and exclude people from it, which is why it was such a cultural clash, because that was just a concept which was beyond their ken.
You write about the Industrial Revolution and the marketing, I guess, that went along with that, and that has kind of created this situation that we are in today, in that we have a lot of stuff. Flesh that out for us.
Well, of course, we've always had things from the very beginning, and what happened generally in the Industrial Revolution is that productivity increased exponentially. But in order to keep keep the commercial machine rolling forward, they had to stimulate consumption. And so during the Victorian era, we started to see the beginnings of advertising, because up to that point, people would have things to show off, to display their wealth, but there wasn't this relentless pursuit, because people, the general public, were not in that sort of competitive state as such. And so this is the beginning of marketing. This is where you bought things because of the advertising. Prior to that, people bought things because they were functionally useful. But as I say, up to that point, it had been basically clothing and jewelry and things like that. But suddenly, everything became competitive. A different dishwasher. Well, they didn't have dishwashers, but, a different, brush or something like that. And this is what Torrance of Ebling calls conspicuous consumption, that people would start to aspire to have status objects. Objects start to be associated with success. And so this was necessary in order to get people to buy more and more things. And so we had obsolescence built into certain products so that people would have to kind of renew them or upgrade each year to get a better one. And then we also had celebrity endorsement. This was figured out by psychologists that if you want to sell something, just pair it with somebody that people admire. And to aspire to be like this person, people would want to buy the same sort of cigarettes or buy the same sort of cologne or something that their heroes were wearing. So there was a very interrelatedness between consumption, marketing, and media.
And I wonder whether advertisers sort of instinctively understand about our desire for novelty, that we're always, you know, seeking something new. And of course, we get that hit of dopamine when it comes to the kind of pleasure associated with novelty.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that, actually. I mean, I would just say that dopamine's been misunderstood. Dopamine is not so much a liking molecule, it's a wanting molecule. The dopamine system really drives you to pursue things, and it's the acquisition which is actually the driving force. Because very often, once you've got what you've been after, it doesn't really deliver as much pleasure as you think it will get. So I see dopamine actually as the instigator of behaviors, going after things all the time. And I think that makes a lot of sense. It explains why, for example, compulsive shoppers can't stop themselves shopping, because it's the pursuit which is so satisfying, not the acquisition. And this is why they very often have, you know, households full of unopened items, because it wasn't really the item they wanted. It was the joy of searching for it.
Well, that gets to the subtitle of your book. Your book is titled Possess, Why We Want More Than We Need, which is an interesting question to ask. Like, what do you want? What do you need? And I mean, I think of need as survival. I mean, you need shelter, you need food, you need water, you need companionship, you need connection. But wanting opens up a whole diverse pile of things that are available.
Yeah, and you're right. It was the deliberate play on words, and I was pointing to the fact that in many ways, as I said, objects are an extension of who you are. They signal to other people your success. So in biology, we have a thing called signaling theory, which explains why the male species, for example, are much more colorful or much more aggressive than other species, because they're signaling their prowess through their displays. That's why the birds, the males of the species, is typically more colorful or has various sorts of displays. In the same way, males in the human species also are peacocking. Social peacocking is a term. Of course, females do it as well. So it's not uniquely to males in the human species. But everyone, well, not everyone, but those of us who seek to you know, garner social status will do so through the acquisition of displays, you know, driving the flash car, wearing the latest designer stuff. And of course, social media amplifies that, because everyone is picturing themselves or showing what they've recently acquired. But that becomes an arms race, because there's always someone else trying to get something more. So you're on this constant treadmill of trying to out Jones the Joneses, as we say, by what you have. So possessions are a way of signaling our successes to others, and that's why we never cease to want more.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Bruce Hood. He's a developmental psychologist in society at the University of Bristol in England, and wrote a book a couple of years ago, Possessed, Why We Want More Than We Need. I'm thinking, though, I mean, some of it is just sort of my own possessions, that I don't care what other people think about, you know, plates that I have. I like them because I like them. And can you understand sort of why it's not necessarily keeping up with the Joneses? It's just maybe accumulating too much, but a certain kind of desire and interest in beauty.
Right, aesthetic values. I totally agree. I mean, I collect as well, by the way. It's not as if I'm a hermit living in an, you know, I've actually got a lot of stuff, and I recognize that I am susceptible to advertising. I buy things I don't necessarily need. But yes, I mean, so that's the sort of, you know, the consumable aspect of possessions. But there is a different component of possessions, which you're referring to, which is this connection to identity and our sentimental attachments to things. And I think that the fact that we seem to accumulate things, as you say, almost like a legacy, is part of the fact that we don't really want to abandon or throw things away. Now, this is known as the endowment effect. This was... again, recently passed away. We had Danny Kahneman, the economist. He discovered this with Richard Thaler in Chicago, another Nobel winner, which is this strange bias that humans overvalue their own possessions. So they would expect more money for things, and they're reluctant to let go of things. And it's partly to do is that we fear loss more than we like acquisitions, as it were. So it's losing things which seems to figure more prominently in our minds. This is Kahneman's prospect theory. The prospect of losing something or abandoning something or throwing it away It's difficult. We don't like that. So we endow our stuff with additional value. And this leads to all sorts of distortions in the way that people hold on to things or ask unrealistic prices. They think their stuff is worth more than other people's stuff. But again, going back to what I was saying about, for example, the hunter-gatherers, not every culture has a strong endowment effect. Those who live in much more collectivist cultures tend to have a much weaker one. So I think it's a manifestation of this individualism, this sense of this object is mine, I value this, and therefore it's worth more than yours.
So from that Western perspective, then if our stuff represents us, is an extension of us, then the thought of throwing out a pair of shoes or giving them away feels like a loss of what, identity?
That's right. And there's some really interesting work showing that you can prime these concepts in people by getting them to think about themselves. So there was a study of individuals who were Hong Kongers. So they had a dual identity of being kind of Western, but also Chinese. And so they did studies where they got them to think predominantly about their Western views and values. And then they got them to do a value of a personal possession. And then they repeated it again. But for the other half of the subjects, they were thought to think about being more collectivist in a more kind of traditional Chinese way. And again, they got them to value things. And when you looked at the endowment effects, it switched according to what people were thinking about. So if they were thinking about themselves as individuals, the endowment effect was stronger. If they were thinking themselves collectivist in a more collectivist way, then it was less. Now, we did this actually in children. We studied this in three-year-olds who don't normally have an endowment effect. It doesn't appear normally in children until around about 6 to 7 years of age, which again is this sort of watershed when there's a major transition in the way the child's thinking themselves. What we did in those studies is we got children to value various toys using a simple scale of smiling faces. The bigger the smile, the more they liked it. And then we gave them the toy and said, this is yours. Okay. And after we'd given them the toy, we then got them to make a picture of themselves and talk about themselves, to make a picture of a friend and talk about their friend, or they had to do a farmyard scene as a sort of neutral condition. We brought the objects back in again, and we asked them to put the value on the objects. And what we found was that those children who'd spent the time just thinking about themselves and talking about themselves and making a picture, they valued their personal object much higher than the groups who were talking about their friends. So that goes to show that if you are primed to think about yourself as an individual, then the objects that you associate with yourself become more valuable.
That you put more value on the objects that you own.
Yeah.
I'm thinking, too, of these stories. I mean, they're stories of people risking their lives to save a child or a dog in a burning house. But you also hear stories from time to time of people risking their lives to save, you know, a coat that's in the closet in a burning house.
Well, I've actually got a bit of video for it comes from the US of a person clinging to the bonnet of their car. And it was probably even a rental. It probably wasn't owned outright. But there's something which is triggered when someone violates your property. That's taken as a personal attack, a personal insult, and it creates a rage. And people behave in really dangerous, you know, unrealistic ways when people threaten property. So that's unfortunate, one of the consequences of having a very strong attachment or association to the object. And of course, B.B. King, the famous jazz guitarist, had a guitar called Lucille.
Yeah.
And the reason that it was called Lucille was he had this guitar, he was in a bar, and a fight broke out over the barmaid called Lucille. The bar caught fire, and B.B. King ran back in to collect his guitar, and he saved it from the fire, and that's why he called it Lucille.
Yeah. I mean, is that about also loving objects, that we can love a guitar or love a coat?
Oh, sure. Yeah, absolutely. I don't see any reason why not. I mean, there's a very intimate relationship with a musician with their instruments. I've heard this many times that people, these are not just simple physical things. These are emotional objects.
You know, I'm thinking about sort of how shopping has changed these days, and it's so much easier to shop online. You know, you see Amazon trucks just everywhere delivering packages. You know, what was a private experience now is public, because everyone knows if you got a delivery that day. But, and even thinking about, you know, tactile experiences, do you think shopping is different, a different experience when people do it online?
I think it is. And I think it's kind of interesting, Marty, isn't it? That, for example, when digital came along, everyone said, well, that'll be the death of books and vinyl. But interestingly, yes, there was a change initially, but people are going back to physical books and they're going back to vinyl now as an incredibly trendy thing to do. And I think it's the physicality of the object, holding it in your hands, makes it that much more tangible. We are physical animals, and so we do like that. And somehow the digital just makes it, well, it just doesn't seem as authentic, does it?
It doesn't. I mean, it depends on what it is. But yeah, and certainly mostly in my world, it doesn't feel that way. But what do you make of the Amazonization of the shopping experience?
Well, it plays into that dopamine chaser, plays into that kind of missed opportunity. Get it now. It's going to be reduced. These marketeers are very smart. I mean, they know exactly how to pull the strings, which make us want to feel that we're missing out, FOMO. We need to get the last bargain price. But it's all too easy. And I think if you don't put in the effort to it, and also the ease of credit that people are given these days, it's a dangerous combination. And whilst I think there's a lot of convenience to it, I think it does stimulate overconsumption. I think if people were honest about what they really do need, I think that we could change behaviors, and we've got to. I mean, we're on a planet of limited resources. We're kind of waking up to that fact now as the weather changes so dramatically, but we do have to think about consumption as a contributing factor.
And we're almost having a break here. I mean, are you talking about just saying no, as was, you know, coined here in the U.S.?
Yeah, just say no. It is a kind of addictive behavior. And you know, we've all seen it, and we grow out of it to some extent. It does depend on where you are in your life and whether you have disposable income or not. So I'm not suggesting everyone should just abandon everything, but we do have to realize that we are being to a certain extent.
And let me just quickly reintroduce you. We are talking with Bruce Hood about the fact that many of us have many, many possessions. Some we have collected over the years, over the decades. Some feel like prized possessions. Some are things that we feel like we just cannot get rid of. Some we hold on to, even though we don't even use them anymore. And again, Bruce Hood is a developmental psychologist in society at the University of Bristol, a professor there, and wrote a book we've been talking about called Possessed, Why We Want More Than We Need. And do stay with us. Much more to talk about after this very short break. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe, and let me just recap what we're talking about. The fact that it's so easy to acquire stuff these days. Some of our things reveal our interests. They reveal who we are. Some of it is forgotten and, frankly, just gathers dust. We're talking about why we get attached to our possessions, what they say about us, and we'll be talking about what it takes to let them go. And again, our guest is psychologist Bruce Hood. You know, Bruce, I was thinking about shopping today and how you can be so particular. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing, but we can be so choosy, thinking about buying a pair of blue jeans, of dungarees. Is it high waist? Is it low waist? Are the pockets here? Are the pockets there? Is it flare? Is it not? And I wonder, just having that kind of choice, it can be overwhelming. But at the same time, it's wonderful to be able to be so specific about what it is that we want.
It's funny you should talk about. I mean, Barry Schwartz is a psychologist.
Yeah, know him. Yes, at Swarthmore.
Yeah, that's right. The paradox of choice. That you would think you'd be happier with more choices, but actually, it does tend to make people more miserable. Many of us, and that's why we order the same thing on the menu every time we go back to our favorite restaurant. We tend not to be adventurous. When the menu has too many items on it, we get overwhelmed. In the same way, if you walk down the aisle in any supermarket, you'll have 50 types of salad dressing, and it can be a little bit too much. We do like to have things restricted to some extent. So having too much choice, I think it does depend on the individual, of course. But I can see that some people just get that, find that just overwhelming. I think it is important that we recognize, not to generalize too much, that there are definite advantages of the of the, you know, the accessibility. And the way that the digital revolution has changed the way that we shop and buy isn't necessarily all bad. Mm-hmm. But I do think we just have to be a little bit more mindful of whether we really need the things that we're getting. And I guess that's what with the subtitle of the book, I was just trying to, my call is not to stop yourself buying things. That happen, you know, that's not going to change. But maybe just to ask yourself, do you really want it or do you really need it? Because one of the things I work on is happiness. That's another area of interest. And, you know, Dan Gilbert has this phrase he calls miswanting. And what it is this kind of general misconception that buying things, retail therapy, will make you happier. And it doesn't. People just get used to things much quicker. So this sort of feeds into this kind of idea that shopping and possessions and owning things is a way to satisfy emotional needs. But that's not generally the case. I mean, yes, there are some, you know, you can take sort of pride in things and you can have the aesthetic value of art, as you say, that you like, Marty. Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't deny that. But if you're of the mindset you need to have the, you know, the latest pair of sneakers or whatever, I would start to say maybe you're falling victim to the power of the chase, as it were, as I call it, the dopamine chaser.
One of the first shows we did on this show, The Connection, was about happiness. And happiness, when you kind of boil it all down, is connection with other people. And then sometimes possessions can bring us together with other people with shared experiences, you know, shared love of teapots or whatever. How do you see happiness?
Hopefully I'll be back on to talk about happiness at some point.
That's right.
You've actually hit it on the head. I believe there are different forms of happiness. So there's happiness which you can do for yourself. You can direct it, self-care if you like. But there's another way, which is to direct your efforts to enrich the lives of others. And I would advocate that that's a much better way to spend your time and efforts, because the happiness that you direct towards yourself, you get used to it quite quickly. It's never really a surprise and the impact isn't that much. On the other hand, if you do something unexpected for someone else, that generates much more authentic happiness. If you buy them something and they're not even expecting it, it really is tangible and it lasts a lot longer. So I believe that we're a social animal. Mm-hmm. And while solitude is fine and maybe looking after yourself is okay, I think you can go too far. It's much better to try and find the commonalities. And that can be done through objects, as you say. I think museums, art galleries, all these wonderful spaces where we can see these incredible works of art and effort and creativity. I think these are the rare opportunities where you can take awe and really enjoy. And it's amplified. I mean, there's studies showing that when people are doing things together, they enjoy those experiences better. And that can include involving objects, of course.
Well, I'm thinking of people that collect things. I mean, they're often, you're part of a group of people that also collect the same things. And part of collecting is you become knowledgeable. And as you say, it is also involved in this sort of hunt, you know, to use the hunter-gatherer metaphor here. But there is the hunt and then the finding, the bagging, the bringing it home. But collecting can connect you to not just objects, but to other people that share your interest.
You know, I'll tell you something, Marty. I'll share something with you that you probably don't know. But for the past, after the pandemic, I started to go out metal detecting. This is a hobby we have in this country where you can find objects. And of course, I live in a part of the world where there is lots of antiquities. So I find Roman coins. And now when I'm out in the, because I live in the countryside, the villagers come up and they find me and they want to know what I've got. And I pull out the objects and they hold it in their hands. They say, oh, isn't that amazing? That was a Roman coin held by a Roman soldier 2,000 years ago. And that gets back to what you were saying a bit earlier on about this sort of, you know, this connection, this sense of history, this continuity. And that's through the physical contact with something which has been missing for 2,000 years and has come back. So, yeah, absolutely. Objects can transport you in a way which is really quite remarkable.
Sometimes it's hard to see the line between collecting and hoarding, but there is, I think, a very important psychological line. And describe the difference for us.
Well, hoarding is when it's pathological. Hoarding is when people literally cannot throw things away, and they will hoard everything from newspapers to to trash detritus. I mean, it can get so bad that, you know, people have been killed by the amount of stuff they've had in the room. It's collapsed on them. Their houses have been absolutely full to the brim with junk. So that's actually a pathological condition. It's related to the frontal lobe structures of the brain. It's related to obsessive compulsive disorder. So these people can't stop themselves doing it. Whereas collecting isn't that. That's a much more, I mean, it can become somewhat a little bit erratic, but hopefully, you know, it doesn't come to the stage where you literally can't move around your house because you've got too many things. But yeah, there's a spectrum, of course. But when it gets so extreme that it falls into the hoarding criterion, then that's really when something should, you know, intervention should take place.
Indeed. I in the past, I've watched some of these programs about hoarding, and you see, I mean, it's tragic where you see people are so attached to something that is buried under trash. But the fact that it's there, even if they can't see it or touch it or play with it or do anything with it, but just the fact that it's there gives them some kind of sense of safety or solace.
Well, I think it's an extreme version of the endowment effect. So again, we all have this endowment effect, but for the hoarder, they literally will experience anxiety, distress at the notion of throwing something away. So for them, it is a really pathological over application of the endowment, where it's a real fear of losing something, to the extent that it's junk usually. So that's when it becomes ridiculous. And of course, as you said right at the top of the show, we have all these storage units. So we're now filling these storage units up. You know, garages used to hold cars. Now they just generally hold everything in the overflow from the house. And that's, again, a manifestation of this overconsumption.
I think I read that there's something more, at least in this country, more than 53,000 storage unit facilities. And I've seen some of these facilities, and they go on forever.
Yeah, yeah. And there are various shows showing that a lot of these things are abandoned. People never go back to them again. And that's the sad tragedy of it all, is that very often these are sold off at auctions. We feel it's the lifetime acquisition, a lifetime of acquisition. And, we depart this world as we all will. But somehow these objects, we just kind of hold on to them.
Your book is dedicated for my lawyer brother, Ross, someone who has made a career out of ownership, but in spite of this, remains one of the most generous human beings I know. And I thought that was interesting because, I mean, he sounds a little different from you. but at the same time, it is possible to love things and own things and also be generous.
Yeah. Thank you for reminding me. I'd forgotten that's dedication.
I read your book. My brother.
My brother is he is an incredibly other focused person. He's very much puts his efforts into it. Lawyers, of course, make a living over ownership, because ownership is a concept. It's a convention. There is nothing in nature to tell you who owns anything. And even things which you would imagine are, you know, uncontested, actually, lawyers can easily challenge you. So owning land, for example, who had it before you and so on. Right. So, yeah, they make a living resolving disputes over that. But, yeah, my brother has managed to not let his professional life play into his personal life, and he is incredibly generous. I'm not saying – I'm sure there's lots of lawyers listening, so I'm not having a go at lawyers.
Yeah,
but I am pointing out it is a peculiar profession when you think about how they're basically policing our conceptual systems.
You also say that ownership, I guess, especially in Western capitalist societies, creates inequality. I mean, there are people that can afford a fancy car, and there are people who clearly cannot.
Yeah. And I'm not making a political statement here about my beliefs about what is the right state of affairs. I think all systems have their flaws, and often they're chiding against human nature. Humans are competitive. Even in sort of collectivist societies, there's competitiveness. It's not as if they're somehow better. But we just have to see in our Western society how the consequences are impacting. And indeed, China is now on a major economic drive. And of course, they now want to have all the, you know, luxury cars and all the sorts of things that we've had in the West for so long. So, there is another story to be told about what's going to happen as cultures become more modernized. But yeah, I think it's important just to realize that inequality is spurns aspiration, which you might say is fine, and you know everybody wants to try and better themselves. But if that stimulates excessive consumption, then I think that's where it's distorted. Only because I think that we have to see the big picture, which is that this is a planet of limited resources, and we're not going anywhere else very soon. So we need to kind of think about how we can protect things for future generations, which is what we tend not to do when we're very self-centered. We tend to want the immediate gratification. We want to buy now. We don't want to wait. And again, it's going back to what I was saying. It's the wanting which seems to be driving the consumption, not the needs.
I mean, do you imagine in a more dystopian future a world of hoarders, in that we're sort of buried as a species, buried under all our stuff?
I know. Wouldn't that be sad?
Really?
I mean, yeah. I think it is. I mean, that's one of the things I'd like to live for a long time. But one of the reasons I'd like to live for a long time is just to see what happens. I'd like to know how we resolve all of this stuff. I mean, sometimes you can get sort of down about it and get despaired about it, but things do change. Right. If you consider, you know, the way that, for example, recycling is now becoming much more acceptable. In the past, people would just want the latest new thing. Now, people are upscaling, they're upgrading, and they're putting value on reusable things. So the new generation, the younger generations, are really prioritizing, you know, reused clothes and stuff like that. So I think it's not inevitable that we keep doing going down this path. We can correct behaviors. So I'm more optimistic.
This is a kind of a weird segue, but as I was preparing for the show, I kept thinking of a visit my family, my husband and I took to Auschwitz a number of years ago. There's a room where you see piles of shoes that were obviously taken from the people that were dragged into Auschwitz. There was also a pile of eyeglasses. And it's just a kind of powerful testament to human beings and obviously the horrors of the Holocaust. It's an image that I keep coming back to when I think about Auschwitz.
Yeah, I've seen that image. I haven't been there, but the suitcases piled high on themselves, and it's the profound aspect of the mundane things. You know, that I suppose it's just realizing these were the personal possessions. And for every pair of glasses and every pair of shoes, there was somebody who owned them, and that might have been their most important thing. So I think you're right. When you see them all gathered together, it's a real visual reminder of, first of all, the fragility of life. It's a reminder also of the atrocities that we can, you know, bestow upon each other. But we are individuals who are defined by the things that we carry around with us and own. And that's what makes us human. I think you're right. I think there are things which are created, which are unique works of art, which speak volumes about the kind of ingenuity of mankind. But there are the mundane things, which also speak to us as a species, which I think are worth considering.
And considering, you know, given no time, you know, what do you take? What would you take with you when you were forced from your house to certain death?
Yeah. I mean, there's a couple of instances in the book I talk about this, sort of people, you know, basically putting their lives at risk to save things, you know, which are of no value. Real, you know, upstairs, you know, there's a story about the shipwreck off Wales in England. And many of the people who drowned because they wouldn't let go of the gold belts. They'd been coming from the gold belts of the Australian gold fields. And so they were they were pulled to their own death. So I think this is a reminder of this relationship we have to things. We've got to recognize that, we come into the world, as you said, with nothing, and we leave with nothing. But in between, we're kind of obsessed and driven for acquisitions of things that we don't necessarily need. And I think we have to get that in about what it is we're sacrificing in terms of our lives, or in terms of our health, in terms of our time spent with others, if we're just in a relentless pursuit of something that ultimately we can't take with us.
Well, Bruce Hood, a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today on The Connection.
Thank you, Marty. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. He's a developmental psychologist in society at the University of Bristol. And again, we were talking about a book he wrote a couple of years ago called Possessed, Why We Want More Than We Need. Well, you can always download a podcast of The Connection wherever you get your podcasts. You can follow us on Instagram and you can find us on Facebook. You can also check out our website for upcoming shows, whyy.org/The Connection, where you can also sign up for our newsletter. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of The Connection. It's produced by Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you for joining us.